Okay, let's follow. Let's give the welcome to Marianne Majas, who will talk about supernovae classification and diversity, the case of stripped CCE supernovae.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, great. Yeah. Great. Thanks for the invitation to be on this beautiful island. Thanks for coming to my talk. We will now switch over to the explosions themselves after we heard all these beautiful talks about the remnants. Before I talk about the details of what I prepared, I want to make sure to introduce my group at NYU, where I'm at as faculty. Fed, who is the co-chair of the LSST transient and variable star group. She's now also going to move on to faculty position at Delaware. Mark, who's a graduate student. Wolfgang, who is a postdoc but will be a faculty at MSU. Tyler, who's a postdoc, and then former students, Yu Tsien, and then Orr, who is now a CFA and SF fellow. Okay. Okay. So before, since we have a diverse audience of different fields, I want to make sure to give you an introduction and a motivation about my talk today. So first I was tasked to talk about the current classification scheme about supernovae. And the fundamental question that we have in this field of stripped envelope core collapse supernovae, which is, what are the progenitors that give rise to the many different kinds of explosions we see? And of course, since the supernova remnant conference too, I will be mentioning CASE, which was a beautiful type 2b supernova as seen by light echoes by work of Armin Rest and others. Then I will talk about the new changes we've had in this field. Just in the last 5 to 10 years, we have a huge revolution in the field of time domain astronomy with new wide field surveys, big collaborations, and also the interest, especially given the interest and connection to gravitational wave sources, that have increased our sizes of objects and enabled us to do new kinds of studies using new cyber infrastructure tools that we have also developed. And I will discuss also a new classification scheme. Then I will move on to talk about the progenitors, these outstanding questions we have about especially GRBs and stripped envelope supernova. GRBs are the most powerful explosions in the universe that can be seen up to redshifts of 10. So, you know, when the universe was only 500 million years old. So they're very, very powerful tools. But before we can use them, we have to understand which stars give rise to them. And then in the recent years, we have a huge explosion of explosive exotica, new mysterious kinds of transients that we don't understand in detail. We don't know what their progenitor stars are, and we don't know what powers their brilliance and the light that we see. So I'll discuss those briefly. And then I will finish with really, you know, exciting prospects that we're living in a great time right now, given the advent of time-domain surveys. Okay. So this is a plot from a paper that will come online soon. It's an invited review for Nature, Astronomy Nature, that shows us the different types of supernova that we know and love in terms of core collapse supernovae. So the type 2s, of course, are the ones with hydrogen. We know them. Type 2 Ns, you know, Nathan and others love them too. There are supernovae that have narrow lives of hydrogen. Type 2 Bs, the one that CASE is, shows hydrogen but also strong helium lines. And over time, the hydrogen lines get removed or disappear, and the helium lines become even stronger. So this is a transition type. The 1Bs don't show hydrogen, or not much hydrogen, but helium. The 1BNs are the ones with narrow helium lines, which we think are due to interaction between a helium shell and the ejecta. Type 1Cs are basically the rejects of the classification scheme. They can show a little bit of silicon, but no hydrogen and helium. And in the last 20 years, the broadline type 1Cs have piqued a lot of interest, broadlines, because they show this broad line of silicon compared to the narrow absorption line here in a normal 1C, and they're the only type connected with long-duration gamma ray bursts. And so these broad lines indicate high expansion velocities, up to 20,000, if not 30,000 kilometers a second. So that's 1/10 of the speed of light, where a significant amount of ejecta is moving. So these are very powerful explosions. which lead to very high kinetic energies, up to the 10 to the 52 ergs, so up to 10 times larger than the canonical core collapse supernova. And as I mentioned, we've had a bunch of different explosive exotica that I'll discuss later on. And there, the types are very different, and we really need spectra to understand them better. So what are the progenitor stars? We think they're due to different kinds of massive stars that have been stripped of their different outer layers. So if you have your hydrogen and helium layer intact, you get a type 2. The ones that have been stripped of hydrogen, but the helium layer, the next inner one, is intact, is a 1b. And the most naked stars, basically the most stripped stars, we think give rise to 1c's. But the question still remains, how do you strip stars? And I will discuss that in a second. So these are called stripped core collapse supernovae. But there is a need for change. You know, this fingerprinting scheme that I showed you has been used since the 1940s from Bade and Mankowski, but there's a need for change for a number of reasons. First of all, it needs to capture the physics of the exploding star better. As you saw earlier, you have different amounts of hydrogen and helium layers in physics and the outer world, but our current classification scheme does not capture that because it only has big bins, right? 2b, 1b, you know, helium, no hydrogen, 1c, no hydrogen, no helium. But nature is not a step function. There are different degradations, so we need a continuous classification scheme that captures that. The other big, you know, elephant in the room is that LSST is going to come online soon, you know, commissioning 2020, full operation 2022 for 10 years. So the big question we'll have is how are we going to deal with the scarce resource of spectroscopic observations and follow-up observations, because LSST is only photometric survey, and as I just showed you, this classification scheme is based on spectroscopy. So how are we going to allocate our SCAR resource to get the most out of classification? When can we do the optimal classification? Okay. The other aspect that needs that calls for need for change is that we want to use all data. Right now, as I showed you in this classification scheme, we only use a few lines, which is just 10% of the whole spectrum. But as you all know, you know, we work really hard to get spectra of supernovae. We work really hard, we, you know, call our friends or have, you know, automated ways. So it's really sad, basically, that we're throwing away 90% of our data. So we want to use a classification scheme that uses all the data. And we want to use new methods, given, you know, since 1940s, we have had a few advances in statistics and, you know, understanding machine learning, so we want to do that too. And we also want to have a quantitative definition of peculiar. And if you're in the supernova world, you've seen lots of papers such as the peculiar type 1b, you know, blah, 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 the amazing supernova, blah, 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 and then the somewhat peculiar type 2b. So according to who? So that's why we need a new classification scheme that I will introduce today. So these are the desired features. So this is a paper led by my graduate student, Mark Williamson. We want to use the, in the higher spectrum, we want to have something that's physically interpretable. You know, as you might know, neural networks are great, but you know, you don't really understand and can physically interpret what's going on. We want to have the class boundaries be determined algorithmically, so it's not just somebody's eye who says, well, I think this is somewhat peculiar. No, we want to have algorithms that run on data automatically and tell us, you know, what's important. And as I mentioned, we want to have a quantitative way to do that. And so that's what we've been doing. So we used principal component spectral discomposition on all our data. So it uses the whole spectrum, not just a few features. We use support vector machine classification. It's a supervised machine learning. And the way we then classify peculiar objects is by looking at a decision, the distance from decision boundaries and looking in comparison to one standard deviation type ellipses, which I will discuss in a second. So these are our results. So the paper, the title is Optimal Classification and Outlier Detection. So what you see here in this busy plot are these two axes for the PCA component 1 and PCA component 3 that we found were the most insightful components. And then here are all your favorite objects of the different stripped envelope supernova types with their components and, you know, in terms of their coordinates. So these are the eigenspectra that PCA gives you. You know, again, algorithmically, there's no hand, you know, kind of turning knobs involved. So it's, you know, the data tells us what it finds, basically. And what you can also see is these kind of decision boundaries between the types. So here, the green are the type 2s, 2Bs, the blue are 1Bs, the reds are 1Cs, and these are the Brolin type 1Cs, and this is done at a phase of 10 days after max. You have to do this at different phases because supernova are transients. They might change their type as a function of time. So you want to do this as a function of time. So this is for 10 days. We also show this one standard deviation ellipses for the different supernova types. So these are the ellipses here that are shown here. This is just a kind of one standard deviation from the center, which is the mean. So as you can see, it's quantitative. So we have a degree, you know, range of numbers, not just, you know, a bin, like a bucket, like either, you know, type 2B or another 1B. So it really captures kind of the transition aspect of supernova stars that have different amounts of hydrogen or helium before they explode. So on that quantitative description for peculiar object is that there are two standard deviations from the mean, and these are objects we highlight in terms of stars. So these are the ones where we also label them. And we actually were able to recover all the weird ones, all the like kind of titles I mentioned earlier in this plot automatically without anybody looking and saying, well, I think this is somewhat peculiar. So here's 94i. Some of you might know 94i. It's the most well-observed and one of the closest 1Cs. Many people call it a prototypical 1C, but you can see it's very far away from the 1Cs. So it's not a typical 1C, and if you want to ask what is the typical 1C, there's basically not any one that is, you know, smack in the center. So there's no typical 1C. You actually have to look at the whole distribution of properties for these objects to understand them and not just hope that there's one that's kind of typical. So we also did this as a function of time. So you see it at, you know, maximum 5 days, 10 days, and 15 days. And you can see just the progression that these ellipses are actually not very well separated at early times, at max, where we actually do lots of our identification. You know, when you look at Alex Filipenko's review paper in 97, he's like, yes, at maximum light. But no, at maximum light, these ellipses actually overlap a lot. And the best time where you can see them most separated is later times, at 10 to 15 days. So this is actually good news. You want to actually make this spectroscopic identification later. Later is better. And that's really important for, you know, ZTF and other, including LCST wide field surveys, in order to schedule your telescope so that it observes objects around 2 weeks after maximum to get the best ID. And so in this paper that's it's out, we also have the, we have also a plotly interactive plot, so you can actually look by yourself all these objects, you know, that are not labeled here to see which object is where and if your favorite object is also here and where it lies in these planes. Okay. So now I'm going to switch to talk about superluminous supernova very briefly. Okay. So yes, we have a new member of the stripped envelope supernova family, which are the superluminous supernova. And as the name says, they're very luminous, you know, two superlatives. But it turns out their spectra are the best way to classify them. They have very interesting, unique spectra, as you can see here. They show this double line of oxygen at early times. They're very blue. And they don't have hydrogen and helium. So they're the family of, you know, 1C, superluminous 1C family. And they're also connected to GRBs, at least one of them, which was an ultra-long GRB. So that's also very interesting. When we did analysis of the largest data sets in the world of Brolin type 1Cs, 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 and superluminous 1Cs, we found that actually these superluminous supernovae have high velocities, as high as Brolin type 1Cs, so up to here, you know, 15, 20,000 kilometers a second. And much higher than normal 1Cs, and similar to broadline type 1Cs. So this mysterious class of objects, these superluminous supernovae that have piqued a lot of attention, you know, every, you know, they have whole conferences dedicated to what are superluminous supernovae, have to have a unification scheme, basically, that accommodates the broad lines that we see very convincingly, and that was also shown later on by Robert Quimby in his big PTF paper. So now the next question is, if these objects, these stripped stars, some of them do produce jets that we see as gamma ray bursts when if we're along the line of sight. But what about all the cases where we're not along the line of sight of the jet? What about if we're here? Where are the off-axis GRBs? They should exist anytime you have a jet. So that's a big question. $1 million, or yes, that Davide Lavazzati mentioned, where are the off-axis GRBs? So that's a big outside question. We haven't found them, but as I will suggest today, we think we have good candidates now. So yes, so coming back to the stars themselves. So what are the progenitor stars? What are the mechanisms by which you remove the outer layers? There have been a bunch suggested. One is if you have a single massive star, more than around 30 solar masses, that has metallicity-dependent winds that remove the outer layers. If you have high metallicity, you remove more. That's how it goes. And also, if you have high luminosity, you remove more mass. The other asks, so these would be very massive stars, so that's very important. What if you have a binary where a Roche lobe overflow onto the companion star removes the outer layers? So this scenario suggests that you can do this at lower masses, 2 down to 8 solar masses, and that mass loss should not be fully metallicity dependent, so you should be able to do this even at low metallicity, because this removal can only happen at high metallicity. And then last but not least, this more kind of exotic channel has been suggested for explaining GRBs as well as the LIGO black holes. As you know, LIGO has been finding a huge number of massive black hole mergers. And the big question is, how do you make such massive black holes in a binary system? And one suggestion has been if you have these kind of highly rotating stars that have what's called, homogeneous evolution, at low metallicity, where you remove the hydrogen because you actually burn it into the, you remove it into the core and then burn it. So these are the three ways. There's actually a fourth one, which is if you have an eruption that then removes the outer layers in a sudden event, and we see actually more and more instances. And the big question, though, still is what is the fraction of those eruptions that happen even in normal stripped envelope core collapse supernovae? So it's really important to understand this because all these objects I just mentioned are really interesting. They're very bright, very luminous, can be seen at high distances, and we really want to understand which stars give rise to them before we can use them as powerful tools. So the direct study is not possible, except for for 2Bs and 1B. So we need a more indirect way to do this on a large data set, to do statistical analysis for stellar forensics. And that's finally possible given the large data sets that people have accumulated and published. I'm sorry. I'm just going to stand here. Okay. So one way to look at this is looking at rates. So this is a plot by my former postdoc, Or Grauer, that shows you the different rates of stripped enveloped supernova compared to type 2s as a function of metallicity. It's a very busy plot, but what you see is that the kind of numbers that increase, the rates that increase as a function of metallicity, cannot be reproduced by single stars. So the single stars are all down here. That's a prediction for single stars. They're all down here. But for binaries, they can reproduce the high fraction because the fraction of stripped enveloped supernova is 30% of all core collapse. That's a huge fraction. So you can't just do that with an IMF that's like Salpeter. You just don't, if there were only single massive stars, because you just don't have enough massive stars above 30 solar masses to remove the outer layers. And so the kind of sentence or statement that binaries are common has been suggested by a number of people, but what about CAS-A, which was, as I mentioned, a type 2B? So I don't have to introduce CAS-A. We know the explosion date very well. Exploded around 1680, was maybe seen but not reported at this very specific distance. We have a neutron star detected. And light echoes are consistent with a type 2B supernova. So where's the companion? If you have a binary system, one explodes, the other one should be moving at very high speeds in some direction. So this is what Wolfgang Kerzendorf has been doing recently in a paper in 2019, searching for the companion of Cassay using HST. What you see here is the center of explosion with its one arc second uncertainty, and then the stars that they saw in deep HST images. And the direction that you see here for these different stars is where the stars were in 1680. So as you can see, none of them are actually at the center of the explosion, to really kind of very high confidence. So his paper says there's no companion for Cassay. Oops. So now we can set upper limits of the companion, given the deep limits that we have with HST. So if you assume different magnitudes of extinction, either 10 or 15 magnitudes of extinction, you get for strip stars less than 2 solar masses using these models by Godberg. Below M0, you can allow white dwarfs and neutron star and black holes, but the kind of scenario that we have, that these would be, you know, in terms of companion stars, something luminous and massive, is excluded. So that's a big puzzle. If most stripped envelope supernova come from binaries, some don't, and Cassay seems to be one of them. Okay. So now I'm going to switch and talk a little bit about metallicity studies. So we have, as you know, there are lots of different surveys. One of them is PTF that operated for a while, then it was IPTF. Now the new survey is called ZTF. Of course, different telescopes for this, different telescope for the same telescope, but a big imager for ZTF. And so for PTF that I was part of, for the host galaxy component, leading the host galaxy component of 100 stripped envelope supernova, we got host galaxy spectra of those. And this is the first large sample from the same survey that's untargeted. And untargeted surveys are really important because they find supernovae the same way GRBs are found, which are in wide field surveys. So what we did there is we compared the metallicities of Brawlin type 1Cs to those of GRBs. As you might have known, there are lots of studies that suggest that GRBs occur at low metallicity, and we used all the data that's out there, increasing the number of in our samples by a factor of 2. So these are supernova GRBs in this scale. We included 7. They're actually a total of 10 small numbers. These are rare objects at high redshifts, so it's really hard to get metallicities and host galaxy studies. But we did our best. We analyzed all the data in the same way, using the same metallicity scales, and we compared then the supernova GRBs to Brawlin type 1Cs in blue, and then to normal 1Cs as like a control sample that are in black. And so what we find, which was surprising, was that the Brawlin type 1Cs with GRBs have similarly low metallicities as Brawlin type 1Cs without observed GRBs. And those metallicities are much lower than of normal 1Cs. And we did this in 4 different scales. We did also different hypothesis testing, including upper limits. We also did it in different kind of scales for the Kolmogorov's test, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, Wilkinson and Arnesen-Darling test, to really be certain whether our results stand using different tests. And in all cases, we got that the Brawlin type 1c GRB metallicities are similar to the Brawlin type 1c metallicities. And we did this also in a different scale. This is the different one. So what we think we see here is that we found, we think, very good candidates for Brawlin type 1c supernova connected with off-axis GRBs. Because remember, the off-axis GRBs are just due to a geometric event, a geometric effect that's independent of the host galaxy. So if the jet that comes out and you see it comes from a low metallicity star, then the same star seen off axis should have led to a non-detection of the jet, because you don't see the jet, but you still see the supernova that's not as collimated. And so they should both have the same environments, which are low metallicity, and so there should be no difference in the host galaxies that we see. So we think these PTF Brawlin type 1Cs are low metallicity, are either off-axis GRBs or perhaps low luminosity GRBs. The limits that we have are not very stringent, so there can be still low luminosity GRBs. Oops. Yeah. And the broad lines in Brawlin type 1Cs seem to really indicate an engine, jet. And that also actually was shown in another paper by us, where we did an end-to-end simulation of putting a jet inside a star, following it, then using Kaysen-Sedona models for making a spectrum and seeing it at different angles. And we saw in all cases we had a broadline type 1c. So the jet seems to produce these broad lines that we see in these special objects. So we think we found these good candidates, at least for off-axis GRBs. These are BTF broadline type 1c's at low metallicity and that have also high velocities. These are consistent with the radio limits. And as a next step, we really need deeper radio VLA observations to detect these off-axis GRBs, because at late times, the jet, even if it's collimated at the beginning, gets becomes spherical and can be detected in the radio at very late times. So we're going to put in a VLA proposal to observe these objects at late times to see if they have this telltale radio emission from an off-axis GRB to conclusively show that they are really off-axis GRBs. So now in the last 5 minutes, I will switch to these explosive exotica and their metallicities. So this is another plot from our paper in Astronomy Nature, where we show on the x-axis the rise time, and then on the y-axis the peak luminosity of these objects. So this is a review paper, so you know, none of our own kind of course, some of our own work, but not original work, where we summarized and put together for the first time all the various samples that people have published, some with and some without spectra. And the point is that these rise times are very, very fast. So there's this new class of objects. Some people call them fast evolvers or FBOTs, fast blue optical transients that can rise in less than 10 days, you know, a few days in some cases, and become still very luminous. So remember, type 1a is at minus 19.6, so some of them are more luminous than a 1a, and much more luminous, up to kind of 10 to 20 to 50 times more luminous than normal core collapse supernova. So the big mystery that we have is, what are these stellar progenitors and what's the explosion mechanism that enables them to rise so quickly and still be so luminous? Nickel cannot do it, basically. Nickel decay that we know and love for all type 1a, type 1as and stripped envelope cannot do it. So one aspect that people have suggested is to look at their metallicities in their host galaxies. So this is a paper from Drought, where she shows in red all these kind of FBOTs that she had in her paper back then and from PanSTARRS. This was just to wake you up. That was, of course, planned to pay attention to these FBOTs. Okay, great, thank you. So people have suggested to look at metallicity, so they seem to be all following the normal star-forming galaxies as seen in Sloan. So these are all in red and very different from the long-duration gamma burst hosts that are all at low metallicity, as I've already mentioned. So recently, we followed, together with our colleagues at LCO as part of the Global Supernova Project, a very interesting object called 2018 GEP, where ZTF, you know, it has this new survey. The public survey goes back to the same part of the sky, more or less in 3 days, or 3 nights, where it had really deep upper limits, though now there's a paper that suggests there might have been some detection of an eruption. But in our case, what we had were upper limits. And then we saw, boom, the object rise very quickly in a couple of days and become very luminous. The other thing was that there was swift UV triggered, so we also have UV data on this object, and it's very, very blue, much bluer than all the other objects in our comparison sample, all the other broadline type 1c's. And it turns out when we took spectra as part of LCO, we saw that it actually changed its type. First, it was a featureless blue spectrum, and then it became a broadline type 1c with really high velocity. So, but again, it's a broadline type 1c, but it is much more luminous and much bluer than all the other broadline type 1c's. And this is another plot to show that rise time as a function of peak magnitude, and it's up here almost minus 20. So more luminous than a 1a, rise time of just around 5 days, and much more luminous and faster than all the broadline type 1c's in a IPTF sample. So this is a really interesting object. We've been following, we're writing it up. There's been another paper out by Anna Ho recently about this object. And what we also did was we took spectra in a particular IFU spectra and made a map of the whole galaxy in terms of metallicity and found that it's in a low metallicity region. It's down here in this drought plot, very different from all these other FBOTs that she had in her paper with and without spectra, and those without with spectra were none of them were broadline type 1c. So in these FBOTs, there seems to be a huge diversity of objects. We really need spectra, so in any kind of your surveys you're in, if you want to follow them, do take spectra, because there are many different kinds of them. It seems like one that are featureless, and they change over time, so not just one snapshot of a spectrum is important, but a whole series. And we also need metallicity studies and host galaxy studies to also understand the diversity of the environments and the stars that might have given rise to them. So if you are interested in metallicity but don't want to go into all the gory details, we actually have a very convenient tool that you can use. It's online called PIMCZ, where you derive metallicity and its confidence regions at many different scales. There's 16 different ones. There's still huge debate which ones to use, but it's an easy one that you can use in terms of its tool and get the uncertainty confidence bands. And it's all available, and if tomorrow there's a new metallicity scales, you can just plop it in, it's modular. Okay. And all our data products, code, and data are all online. On our website here, SNYU, as well as our GitHub repository, we really have a strong vision for open science, so we also make our code public. We made also our code for making plots public, because we really believe in transparency and sharing it. And that's actually been really helpful for many fields. Specifically, we also added lots of templates for the SNID tool that people use for identifying supernovae. Also, if you want to share data, I highly recommend you share data. And you don't want to have your own GitHub repository or make a website like we did. So actually, here is a spectrum of 90BW, which was a supernova GRB, overimposed on the Manhattan skyline. And you can see that it predicts the next skyscraper right here. So, you know, spectrum is truth, and it's very predictive. So if you don't want to make that yourself, there's actually easy tools these days to share your data. So I highly recommend you upload your data on the Open Supernova Catalog so you don't have to deal with what I had to deal with, which is when I asked a colleague to send me his spectrum that was published, he said it was on a laptop 3 laptops ago. So we had to scan in the JPEG. So please don't do that. Please upload your data. So my conclusions are, we are entering an era of statistical analysis of supernovae. So the era where you have one object and you know you studied in detail is still interesting, but now we have the power of statistics. All these different surveys are producing them, they're finally publishing them, hopefully they're making them also publicly available, and we could do interesting analysis on the whole data set. But we also need a new classification scheme, as I outlined today. So what we found when we do statistical analysis is that binaries are common for stripped supernova, but not for Cas A. So the next steps for Wolfgang is to search whether there's a cluster that, from which that massive star, because if it's not a, doesn't have a companion, it must be then perhaps a massive star where it must have came from. The other aspect that we found when we do a statistical analysis as a population, broadline, superluminous supernova, a broadlined, so any kind of exotic model that you have, interaction, magnetar, whatever, has to explain the broad lines. And then when we look at PTF, we find that the supernova GRB metallicities are very similar to broadline type 1c metallicities in that sample, which are much lower than 1c's. So we think we have very good candidates for off-axis GRBs that we hope to verify soon. We have also an emerging field of explosive exotica. Now that we also search in different timescales, we actually pay attention to these, not just type 1As. We find many different new kinds of exotic objects that we're trying to figure out. And next steps. It's going to be a challenge for supernova modelers because they really have to reproduce the full diversity. It's no longer enough to just use one object, and whatever you do, don't use 94i. It's not a prototypical 1C. But we have to now reproduce the full diversity and not just one object. So it's more work, but it's more physically insightful, I would say. For the next step is to also do unsupervised machine learning. So right now it was supervised, it was reproducing the classification of SNID, but now the new advances that we have, we want to find new types, new objects. So that's best done with unsupervised machine learning. And then as the last part that I didn't have much time to discuss, but in order to understand the progenitor stars, a new tool has become very powerful, which is early observations of young supernova just hours after they explode. So the spectroscopy and the light curves you get are very insightful about which kind of star exploded. Thank you.
Okay, we have 5 minutes for questions.
Okay, I think that he is first. Okay.
Miriam, you covered a lot of ground there. Wonderful stuff. Comment, funny, you're using exotica, but one, that's almost a synonym for peculiar, right?
That's and
right. I mention this because Rafaela Margudi and I wrote a chapter on peculiar supernovae, trying to come up to the origin of that. And unpublished fact, we found that there was a correlation between stage in career and use of peculiar. I found it myself. I've traced at least 2 papers where I've used peculiar or something anonymous myself. So
well,
I completely
it's not fully
relate
true.
With
so
that.
Alex Filipenko, if you do that, he's very senior. He's on the most papers with the title peculiar.
That's right. That's right. In our chapter, we spearhead that discussion saying he was the one. One of the first people to use peculiar, which by itself, and this brings up part of the point, one of the first use of peculiar supernova was actually just a late time spectrum of a type 1bc supernova.
Yes. What's your question?
The question, yes. The problem with classifications, and you talked about the best epoch by which to do it, right? It's strongly motivated also by the type of science that you want.
That's right. Right?
If you had the opportunity to do as early a spectrum as possible or late as possible, it depends on what kind of science you want out of it, because at early times you're capturing more of the photosphere than you would at the later time when they begin to settle down, and I believe that as well. My question is this, in your classification, right, did you consider using spectra and photometry as part of the identification, as opposed to just whether you could suss it out with spectroscopy in the best
question.
Time.
No, we didn't do photometry. We only use spectroscopy because that's, in terms of the scheme, you know, classification scheme, it's the spectra. But as of course, you know, talking about LSST, you have to do photometric classification on the thousands of supernova that will be found by LSST. So as you know, there was a huge challenge called the plastic challenge, where a lot of people were able to send in their models and doing a kind of mock run on fake supernova data produced by LSST. And so they had a big challenge. They found somebody who was wrote the best code. However, if you look back, and we found that, and I'm discussing that with the plastic people, their models for 1Bs, 1Cs are wrong. So we're working on that too as a next step. But this paper we focused on spectra, and I fully agree. It depends on your signs. This was just for classification. If you just want to have classification, you want to do rates. Then this is the date phase range you want to get the ID. However, if you want to have young supernova, and for all types, young supernova are really interesting. So actually, we, as part of the Global Supernova Project and others, we've discussed of just triggering as early as possible on any young object, and then whatever type it is will follow or not, and so forth. But spectra as early as possible, even hours later, are the best. For different kind of science, for understanding progenitors too.
Let's make short questions so we
yes,
have time
short
for
questions.
Everybody.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm Melina, and then you.
I will. Okay, thank you for the nice talk. I have a question related with the classification. You say that the best epoch that you find is 20 days after the maximum?
Yes,
and what
10
about
to 20
the
days.
Type 2B options?
So yes, the type 2Bs were in there, so I can show you the plot. The type 2Bs are also in there, and they're most separated at 10 to 20 days.
Yeah, something that I cannot fully understand, because as I noted, that the hydrogen line you only see at the early time.
Yeah, but the heliums become stronger. So now you wonder, what is this based on? So if you look at the eigenspectra, the first 5 that you use, that have the highest test scores, and the ones I showed you, they actually have hydrogen and helium. So you need both, not just the hydrogen, to differentiate between the different types. But I'm happy to discuss this and show you the paper about this.
And the other thing is that related with the fast evolving object, could you also classify, or is not possible?
Yes, so the fast evolving ones, they're with and without spectra. So big surveys, they just want to have a paper out, they just have photometry, so because the kind of definition is only photometrically, they rise very quickly, less than 10 days. But we really need spectra because they show different types. One was a Braulard type, 2 of them are Braulard type ones, these others just featureless continuum. Others don't show any lines that you can see. So we really need to get spectra to fully understand this kind of zoo of fast evolvers. They're not all the same.
Okay, you want one more question?
On the search for the off-axis GRB, there are some broad-lined type 1c supernovae.
Yes, the sample that I showed from PTFL broadband type 1c.
For such supernovae, the deep radio upper limit has been given.
Yes, and, but they're not very deep. So if you, this is the Corsi paper, so she's part of PTF. So if you look at it, she herself says that some of the limits that she got are not as deep to fully exclude low luminosity of axis GRBs. So really need very deep limits.
But standard GRB afterglow analysis, such radio upper limits have shown that there is no relativistic jet.
Well, not for this sample. So as I said, for this sample, there are few. The deepest one is O2AP, so I agree. There seems to be no jet. It's very nearby, very deep radio limits. But if you look at the radio limits, they're not very stringent. So some of the models are below it. But I can show you the Corsi paper. That's not my work. That's her work. Yeah.
Well, last question and continue discussion. Over there, the last a brief question.
Nathan, you can ask me a question over coffee.
Hi. Quick question still about classification. So now we're relying on four classes, and you still use four classes also on your scheme. Like, have you thought of going forward, like maybe reducing the number of classes or like putting more?
Yes, new ways. So that's what I mentioned about. Thank you. Very good question. So what we did was what's called supervised machine learning. So we tried to find an algorithm that reproduces the current classification scheme, but has a continuous way to do it, right? The next step will be unsupervised, where we just let it run and see if it finds clusters by itself. And so we'll see if we get, you know, clusters that are many or less than that, and also to find new transients, new kinds of, you know, spectra that we haven't fully realized as such. So that's going to be the next step, and then it will be using all the data, including these, you know, peculiar, exotica, fast evolvers, and so forth. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Marianne.